The HBO series Band of Brothers is a masterpiece. It depicts the story of Easy Company, a highly decorated paratrooper unit who played a pivotal role in World War II. Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg's telling illustrates countless lessons on leading, following, personal sacrifice, and collective courage, just to name a few. But the one scene in the entire series that forever stands out in my mind is the attack on a city named Foy. Prior to the attack, Captain Dick Winters appoints Lieutenant Norman Dyke to lead a portion of the assault. Now, it's important to know that Captain Winters is a remarkable leader. He had ascended up through the ranks quickly and was respected by all his men as a brilliant strategist and a masterful tactician. He's the kind of leader that you want to follow into battle. Lieutenant Dyke, on the other hand, is portrayed as a bit of an absentee officer, nicknamed Foxhole Norman for his persistent and curious disappearances, and his penchant for hiding in his foxhole rather than fighting on the front lines. It's implied that his appointment to the position of leadership in Easy Company had a lot less to do with his qualifications and a whole lot more to do with him being the son of a New York State Supreme Court judge. Unfortunately, privilege doesn't protect you from enemy fire. Because if it did, Lieutenant Dyke wouldn't have found himself at the center of a major crisis on January 13, 1945. As he and his men charged the enemy-occupied town of Foy, they came under heavy fire. The strategy was to move fast before the Germans could bring their heavy artillery down on them. But midway through the charge, confusion sets in. Dyke gets disoriented. He orders Easy Company to hold up, the absolute last thing you should do at a moment like this. They're exposed. They're sitting ducks. His men plead with him to take cover. Captain Winters shouts from his command post at the rear, "Keep moving forward!" But Dyke is spiraling. Members of Easy Company fall one after another after another. A few moments later, crouched behind a straw hut with fellow soldiers demanding that he take action, Dyke freezes. He's non-responsive. Catatonic. Overcome with frustration, Captain Winters grabs his rifle and begins to charge the battlefield, dead set on personally relieving Dyke from his command. But he's immediately called down by his superior, Colonel Sink, who shouted, "Winters, you do not go out there." Now, I often use this story when I'm teaching leaders to illustrate the tension that creative leaders feel, especially those who have come up through the ranks, in moments when the stakes are high and failure seems imminent. We want to revert back to being the technicians. We want to charge into the fray. We want to take control. We want to do the work. But when you're leading work, that's not your job anymore. And while I still think it's a striking cautionary tale to that end, what often gets overlooked is why Winters felt the need to rush the field in the first place. In other words, what can we learn from this story if, instead of putting ourselves in Captain Winter's shoes, we don the role of frozen foxhole Norman Dyke? I bet for all his faults, Dyke was a lot like you and me. He wanted to do the right thing. He wanted to be brave. Yet in this moment, he shows us that maybe cowardice isn't the worst alternative to bravery. What Dyke did was actually more deadly. He froze up. Sometimes the greatest threat to bravery isn't cowardice, it's paralysis. As creative pros, paralysis is a cancer. And I'm not talking about the tyranny of the blank page kind of paralysis that we all experience. Those moments are real, but they're just part of the gig. The paralysis I'm talking about is harder to detect because it's disguised as busyness, as boredom, or conventional wisdom. The truth is, you might be paralyzed right now and not even know it. On today's show, we explore those moments when Captain Winters is on our shoulder shouting, "Keep moving forward," but we just can't. We're paralyzed. What do you do now when you're just not sure what to do next? This is Daily Creative, and my name is Todd Henry. Welcome to the show. The year 1978 was a year unlike any other. The Bee Gees dominated the airwaves. Grease was on the silver screen. Smallpox had just been eradicated. But perhaps the biggest news of all, I was in love. I was also 5 years old. Her name was Jenny, and I desperately wanted her to notice me. But Jenny was a catch, and it seemed like every other boy in our class was angling for my girl, my Jenny. I had to up my game if I was ever going to compete. So one day at recess, it came to me. I would climb to the top of the tallest set of monkey bars, then swing upside down by both legs, shouting her name. I mean, what girl could possibly resist such charm? I could already hear the wedding bells chiming in the distance, but recess was nearly over, so I had to act fast. Up the monkey bars I raced and quickly maneuvered my way out to the middle before securing my legs, swinging backward into the inverted position and shouting, "Hey Jenny, look at me!" The playground fell silent. In my love-drunk frenzy, I hadn't noticed that the recess bell had rung. While I was busy scrambling to my perch, everyone else had lined up to go back inside. At first, there were just a few giggles, and then there were laughs, and eventually came the mocking, "Hey, Jenny!" There I was, the lone lover boy suspended in a cloud of humiliation. And the worst part? I didn't have an escape plan. How was I going to get myself out of this mess? I managed to pull myself right side up, one hand on one rung and the other on another, but I was stuck. I couldn't seem to let go, but I also couldn't hold much longer. There was nowhere to go but down, and my 5-year-old frame couldn't survive a fall into the gaping abyss below. The things we do for love. Thankfully, one of the teachers came to my rescue, lifting me by the waist until I was back on solid ground. But it would be weeks before I would escape the snickering. And Jenny, well, she moved on. And so did the rest of my friends. They eventually forgot about it completely, but I never did. In fact, even to this day, it still stings just a little bit. Looking back, I don't regret the decision to go for it and take a chance. I regret putting myself in a situation I couldn't get out of. There's a term used to describe why I wound up trapped in that moment. Brachiation. It's a term used by childhood development to describe the ability to swing from one hold to another. Letting go of one bar while simultaneously grabbing a hold of another is a skill, just like any skill that has to be developed. That is, unless you prefer living in a perpetual state of needing rescued, which I don't recommend. At this point in your development, you've probably mastered physical brachiation. But psychological brachiation can be much more difficult. Brave decisions can quickly turn into moments of indecision, clenching two different rungs with both hands. And before you know it, you're just like 5-year-old me, unable to let go of the way things have been and move on to something new. Paralysis. And if you've ever felt like this, and maybe you feel like this right now, the first step to learning how to brachiate is accepting the fact that if you want to move forward, you have to let go of something. Back in the mid-20th century, the family car of choice was the station wagon. It goes by many names, the grocery getter, the land yacht, the Vista cruiser, fake wood paneling on the outside, third row seating on the inside. It was an icon of the American dream and a mainstay of General Motors. But by the late 1970s, times were changing. Baby boomers were looking for something with more style and fashion than the stale station wagons of their forefathers. Thus, the Chevy Nomad 2 was born in 1979. It was too tall to be a wagon, but too streamlined to be a van. GM had a smash success on their hands. Deep down, Americans had a minivan-shaped hole in their hearts, and the Nomad 2 was the perfect fit. But wait a minute, you might be thinking. Why was it that as a kid, your parents never drove you to Gatlinburg in their Nomad 2? Or mom never picked you up from soccer in her Nomad 2? Or you never fought tooth and nail with your siblings over who got stuck in the middle seat of the third row of your Chevy Nomad 2? It's because in 1984, Chrysler introduced families to the car of their dreams. If you can believe it, the Dodge Caravan, which launched an entirely new category, it then proceeded to dominate for nearly 2 decades. To date, Chrysler has produced well over 15 million minivans since 1984. It's considered the biggest engineering, design, and sales accomplishment in the company's history. Yet, it should have been the Nomad 2. How could GM have let this happen? Well, the truth is, GM never released the Nomad 2. They were hanging from the monkey bars with a bad case of poor brachiation. As much as they loved the Nomad 2 concept, and as convinced as they were that the American car buyer was craving its not-quite-a-van, not-quite-a-wagon mystique, they still had one hand on the traditional station wagon, and they couldn't let go. After all, station wagons had been their bread and butter for years. Sure, sales were softening, but they were still highly profitable. What if this new small family van concept wound up eating into their precious station wagon market? Could they really afford that loss? Ultimately, GM killed the Nomad 2 concept and left the opportunity wide open for Chrysler, a decision that drastically altered the futures of both companies. But here's the real irony. When was the last time you rode, or even saw, for that matter, a traditional station wagon? Station wagons, at least as we knew them back then, are practically extinct. They've all evolved into SUVs or crossovers. The traditional station wagon is dead. GM passed on the biggest concept in recent history, all for the sake of something that doesn't even exist anymore. If you're feeling paralyzed, hanging from the monkey bars with one hand on one rung and one hand on another, struggling to drum up the courage to let go so you can reach for what's ahead, maybe this is the nudge you need. What if the biggest barrier to making the brave decision isn't that you think too little of what you don't yet have? It's that you think too highly of what you have right now. Maybe the things you're clinging to aren't worth nearly as much as you think they are, and you just don't know it yet. Maybe, just maybe, you're white-knuckling a station wagon when you could have had a caravan. Okay, but what about those moments when we freeze up, not because we can't decide between A and B, but because we can't decide whether or not we should quit altogether? I mean, unless you've never tried anything creative ever in your life, you know the feeling I'm talking about. Once the initial excitement and enthusiasm wears off, what's left behind is the hard work. And hard work has a knack for making us want to quit. Yet everybody knows that winners never quit and quitters never win, to quote Vince Lombardi. So what do? You don't want to quit, but you also don't necessarily want to not quit either. Once again, you're paralyzed. I've seen many a creative pro stay stuck in this state of paralysis for months or even years without much of a handbook for navigating this tension.
No one had ever written a book about quitting. In fact, people aren't even good at talking about quitting.
That's Seth Godin from my interview with him back in 2007, just before the release of his book, The Dip.
A dip is that moment of pain or suffering or hard work that separates the masses from the best in the world. The best example is organic chemistry on your way to becoming a doctor. If it weren't for organic chemistry, lots of people would become doctors, and becoming a doctor wouldn't be worth very much because it'd be too many doctors. But organic chemistry is the filter. It's that moment when it's easy to quit.
So this is the good news and the bad news. No matter your career, your work is going to be hard. There's no way around it. But there's also good news, because that means that most people can't or won't put in the work to become great. Difficulty creates opportunity. Or to quote Thomas Edison, opportunity is missed by most people because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work. So, by all means, don't quit. The worst thing you could do is quit. Or is it?
What I set out to do was give people some words and some imagery that would help them understand that quitting, contrary to what Vince Lombardi would have you believe, is not a bad thing. It is, in fact, a really good thing.
Godin's dip metaphor works like this.
Either you're facing a dip or a cul-de-sac, another word for a dead end. And let me describe the difference between the two. If you see that there's something on the other side, then you can marshal your resources, push through, and get out on the other side as a winner. You're in a dip. A dead end, on the other hand, is like one of those hamster wheels that the gerbils run around, around, and around on. It never leads anywhere. It never gets anywhere. It goes nowhere but down. And all too often, we get comfortable on a cul-de-sac. We get stuck on that wheel and never get off it and end up being average for a really long time. And so the goal as a creative professional is to get off the dead ends, stop working on the cul-de-sacs so you can focus all of your energy on getting through the dips.
The dip helps us orient ourselves. It gives us language for describing where we are on the journey. Have we been at it for a while? Is it hard? Are we wondering if we're ever going to reach the finish line? Do we feel like giving up? Welcome to the dip. The decision to quit comes down to this. Can you still see the other side? Do you still have the drive to keep going? Will success be worth it? If so, keep going. You're just in a dip right now. It's perfectly normal. But if you're really honest with yourself and you've lost vision, you've run out of drive, and you aren't willing to pay the price that success demands of you, then you're probably in a cul-de-sac. And those go nowhere. You should quit. Pushing through the dips that matter most in our work and our life takes energy. Don't waste yours on a dead end. Lombardi was wrong. Winners quit all the time. I suppose you could say that it all comes down to being decisive. Choosing to let go of one thing so that you can take hold of another. Choosing to push through the dip to get to the other side. Choosing to quit the cul-de-sacs that ultimately go nowhere. So if you're feeling paralyzed, choice is the solution. But for some of us, choice isn't the solution. It's actually the problem.
I'm someone who's always had a lot of different interests. You know, growing up, I was really into the arts. I liked English a lot. I played in a band. I built websites. I went to law school. I've dabbled in various different fields and industries. And for a long time, I always kind of wondered what was wrong with me. You know, why can't I just kind of pick one thing and stick with it? That seems like what we're supposed to do.
Emily Wapnick is a self-proclaimed multi-potentialite, a term that she coined in her book, How to Be Everything, a guide for those who still don't know what they want to be when they grow up. And if you're thinking, a multi-potential what?
Yeah, a multi-potentialite is someone with many interests and creative pursuits. It comes from the word multi-potentiality, which is a term in psychology used to refer to people who display aptitudes across multiple disciplines. Some people will say generalist or polymath or Renaissance person. I like multi-potentialite, and I always tell people that they can use whichever word they like. Basically, it means you're really curious about a bunch of unrelated subjects.
Historically, multi-potentialites are frowned upon among serious people. They're seen as flaky, aloof, undisciplined, or any number of when-are-they-going-to-get-their-act-together-isms that get used to describe someone who can't seem to buckle down, specialize, stick with it, and just be happy. And if that's you, there's often a different kind of paralysis that you experience. You know that if you ever want to be successful, that you have to make a choice, yet you simply can't. You're curious, you're interested, and you're too excited by too many different pursuits, and the thought of saying no to any one of them absolutely crushes your soul. But what if you had permission to not make a choice and still achieve the things you want to achieve? That's what Emily explores in her book.
When I was researching the book, I interviewed about 50 multi-potentialites who self-described as being both happy and financially comfortable, and I wanted to know how they make a living. I realized that there are these four work models that people tend to use to get the variety that they need into their career and into their lives. Take what you will from these four models and feel free to customize them. So the first commonly used work model is what I call the group hug approach. And that is if you were to imagine your many interests coming together in one big group hug, but that's when you have one multifaceted job or a business that you run. So you get to wear a lot of different hats and kind of morph between roles in that one work project. So maybe this means that you work in an interdisciplinary field like urban planning or design or sustainable development, and you kind of need to understand different sectors and different industries. Or maybe you work for an open-minded organization that lets you kind of step out of your role and assume other responsibilities and try new things and pitch projects. Or maybe you have a business. I mean, just running a business means you wear many different hats. And the second one is what I call the slash approach. And this is where instead of combining your interests, you've got several part-time, like discrete revenue streams. So two or more part-time jobs or businesses that you kind of flip between over the course of your week. So it's called the slash approach because this is the person who is a programmer slash teacher slash stand-up comedian, you know, so they've got these three very different things. They're not combining them, but they kind of move between them over the course of their week. And then you've got the Einstein approach. I use this name because Albert Einstein worked at the patent office for several years. He was basically employed by the government. So he had this stable day job that paid the bills, took care of his financial needs, and then he explored his theories on the side. So if you're using the Einstein approach, you might have what author Barbara Sher calls a good enough job, which is a job that you enjoy well enough, and it takes care of your financial needs, it pays the bills, but it leaves you with enough freedom, enough free time and creative energy to kind of explore your passions on the side. And that's really important because if your job takes up your whole life and you're answering emails late into the night and you're totally stressed out and exhausted, you're not going to have time to pursue all those other passions. But people who use this work model really love it because it takes the pressure off of needing to monetize every little thing that you're into. So I interviewed a guy named Charlie Harper, who is an IT director by day. And then when he leaves the office, he goes to musical theater practice and a cappella practice. And on the weekends, he builds furniture and he just built a boat. And then you've got the fourth commonly used work model, which is the Phoenix approach. And I called it the Phoenix approach because it's kind of like the Phoenix, which has its glorious life. And then at the end, it bursts into flames and is reborn from the ashes. So this is someone who dives deep into one career, into one field for a number of years, and then kind of hits the point where they're like, okay, like I'm ready for something new. And then they start a new career in a totally different field and they make that transition. And usually they will develop that next thing on the side and kind of develop relationships and look for opportunities before they make that transition.
As a multi-potentialite, perhaps you identify as one or even a hybrid of these multiple models, and that's totally normal. The hope is that you see a path forward that wasn't there before. You have permission to not choose. You have permission to try to do it all. But wait, isn't that a recipe for mediocrity? Being okay at a bunch of things rather than great at something, isn't that a losing strategy? Well, I can't help but think of the words of maybe the most famous multi-potentialite, Steve Martin, who was not only a stand-up comedian, but wrote best-selling novels and movies and acted for many years and even won a Grammy for playing bluegrass music. In his autobiography, he wrote, "Despite a lack of natural ability, I did have the one element necessary to all early creativity, naivete, that fabulous quality that keeps you from knowing just how unsuited you are for what you're about to do." So in summary of today's episode, there really are three different strategies we looked at for those moments when you feel stuck. The first is to consider whether you're holding on to something that you need to let go of. Are you suffering from a case of poor brachiation? Do you need to let go so that you can move forward? The second is to consider whether you should quit altogether. And this is what Seth Godin talked to us about. Are you in the dip, which means it's just really difficult and you need to push through because you still see the other side? Or are you in a cul-de-sac going round and round and round and you simply just need to cut ties and move on? And then finally, maybe you feel stuck because there are so many possibilities that you don't know how to choose what to do. And maybe you can apply one of Emily Wapnick's strategies for multi-potentialites to help you move forward. If you'd like to listen to the full interviews with Seth Godin and Emily Wapnick, you can do so in the Daily Creative app at dailycreative.app. There you'll also find additional resources to help you apply what we talked about today and daily prompts and challenges to help you stay brave, focused, and brilliant. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider purchasing one of my books. There are 7 of them. You can find them wherever books are sold. Just search for Todd Henry. Or you can subscribe to the Daily Creative app, where you'll receive full interviews, videos, courses, supplemental materials, and daily prompts and challenges to help you be better as a creative professional. You can subscribe at dailycreative.app. Daily Creative is produced by Joshua Gott. My name is Todd Henry. Until next time, be brave.